Welcome back to Lockdown Toronto. I really appreciate you tuning back in. My guest today is Colin Furness. He's an infection control epidemiologist, and he's spent the bulk of his work developing tools that track the spread of infectious diseases, and he currently works at the University of Toronto as an assistant professor at the Faculty of Information. He joins us today to speak on COVID, what its potential ugly third wave looks like, and the future of how Toronto and the world will and should deal with this disease. It's a great show, very informative on the new variants of COVID-19 and what to expect with society opening up. We talk everything from global to local. It's a long overdue discussion on Lockdown Toronto, and I was happy to have it with my guest, Colin Furness. Colin, welcome to the show. I really appreciate you being here and taking the time with us today to walk through some of the important issues when it comes to lockdown, the spread of infectious diseases, and help us understand what the path forward looks like. But first, feel free to tell us what you do, what occupies your time these days, and also when there's not a global pandemic happening.
Well, my day job is as an assistant professor at the Faculty of Information at the University of Toronto. I'm a teaching stream faculty member, so I teach information professionals. I'm cross-appointed to the School of Public Health, where I have a degree in epidemiology. And so, up until the pandemic started, if you'd asked me how I like my job, I think I would have said, it's perfect. I love it. There's just one thing. I don't really get to do so much public health. And that may be a great big lesson, and be careful what you wish for, because, of course, the last 10 months, that has occupied a lot of my leisure time. I still have a day job. I still need to get that done. So all of this, kind of goes on top of that. I'm not involved in doing research in COVID. The reason why I end up talking a lot about this is, I was a social scientist before I became an epidemiologist. A lot of epidemiologists, study microbiology. They study the sciences, hard sciences. They go in, or math, and they go in. There's a lot of different kinds of epidemiologists. I sit really at the intersection of human behavior, how people think, and how people behave, how organizations think, and how organizations behave. So that's my field there, is knowledge management, and also epidemiology. So it's a funny mix of social science and biomedical science. So that's the perspective that I bring, a little bit different than some other epidemiologists.
Well, I really appreciate you being with us today, especially because so much of your time is demanded between those two pursuits and those two disciplines, I guess, being able to convey to the public what's going on in a concise way that's easy to understand, which is how I found you. I've seen a bunch of your discussions on various media outlets about this potential ugly third wave that we may or may not experience given our policy directions in the next little while. Can you explain a little bit about what that third wave is and what it might look like in Toronto and Ontario?
Well, I think the best way to understand what we think is coming is to look at what has recently happened in the UK and Ireland. They were experiencing a decline in cases, as we are actually seeing globally right now, which looks like really good news, and of course it is. But communicable disease does tend to move in waves, and the idea that it's subsiding does not mean it's going. What the UK and Ireland experienced was a sudden, dramatic, and really large rise in number of cases that seemed quite baffling. Fortunately for us, fortunately for everybody, the UK does a lot of measurement. They're very good at measurement. They do a lot of analysis. They did genomic analysis, and they identified a variant. And that variant went from being negligible to accounting for almost all the cases in a very short period of time. So that's what they experienced. If we look at the genomic data that we have here in Ontario, we don't have much of it yet. We see cases are declining overall, but variant cases are actually increasing. And we just haven't seen that happen. We haven't seen it in the data yet. That is to say, it's not a net increase, but we're expecting that to happen fairly soon. Is it definitely going to happen? I can't think of any reasons why it wouldn't. And so that's what makes me feel that yes, we're gonna go through what they went through. The good news is that they were able to control it. The bad news is it took extreme measures to do it. So it really feels like we're not out of the woods yet. We have this one last one. My feeling is that because of warm weather coming and vaccination coming, and the fact that we are already pretty experienced at implementing and living through very restrictive measures, this may be a very short third wave. That's my hope. But I do think we're going to see a really precipitous rise in cases. And the reason why I call it ugly, the reason why I'm really concerned about it, is that if we get a lot of cases in a very short period of time, our healthcare system gets overwhelmed. And it's been pretty straining. It's been pretty bad. For people working in acute care, it's been a pretty grim time. And to have an onslaught now, if that overwhelms it, if we have to do triage, then we are dealing with preventable deaths, deaths of people who wouldn't die if they just got medical treatment. And we have to remember that's very important. COVID is not killing very many people who are not old, but part of that is due to the fact that they're getting excellent medical treatment. And so that's something we need to protect. And that's what I'm concerned about.
Right. And of course, you're speaking to the UK variant B117 and the South African variant B1351, which are both currently present in Canada, are they not?
They are, and I think we have detected the Brazilian variant in Peel. That's my understanding, is that's a new development over the last several days. We shouldn't be surprised. We've been welcoming flights from Brazil. We've been welcoming flights from South Africa. We've been welcoming flights from the UK. And we've been welcoming flights from countries that in turn welcome flights from those places. So it shouldn't surprise us at all. These viruses don't swim, but they do travel very well on airplanes.
Yeah, and we'll get into the federal policy and the mismanagement or criticism that is levied towards that a little bit later. But in terms of these variants, let's go down that road a little bit. The current vaccines, the Pfizer, the Moderna, the AstraZeneca, they say or claim, as of last month, they claim to be effective against these new variants. Is that something that is familiar to you as well, or is the jury still out on that?
It's getting progressively more complicated because we have more vaccines to think about and more variants to think about. Both are moving targets. And so to try and talk about the relationship between the two, what you say one day may be a little bit out of date the next day. We know the AstraZeneca vaccine is not particularly effective against the South Africa variant. That's been more or less sorted out, maybe less than 10% effective, which is to say not effective at all. So that's a problem. My general model or metaphor for explaining vaccines, viruses, and mutations and resistance is a cops and robbers model. So your immune system is the cop. And the vaccine provides the immune system with a picture of the bad guy. So the cop is standing in a crowd, and the cop's got a picture of the bad guy, right? So the immune system knows what to look for. The bad guy, which is the virus, is out in the crowd. That's out in your body. And if the picture matches, the cop has no problem finding this person in the crowd. That's the cop has been very well trained and is very alert. However, the bad guy in the crowd is capable of donning some disguises. So they may get sunglasses, they may put on a hat or a wig, they may apply makeup, get a tattoo, put on jewelry, they may change gender, they may do all sorts of things to hide their appearance. Maybe a sunglasses or a hat isn't going to be such a big deal, but by the time you get into all of those things or several of those things, it may make it harder and harder for the cop to actually identify the bad guy based on the picture they have. That means needing to retool vaccines so that essentially we'll hand the cop updated pictures. You know, this is what they look like today. And so there is a cops and robbers aspect to this in terms of the cops are trying to get the intel they need to find the bad guys, and the bad guys are trying to disguise themselves so that they are not noticed by the cops. That's what we have with the virus and vaccines and variants.
So in your estimation, and this might be a little bit too early to tell given the vaccine rollout is currently happening in most countries relatively slowly. In Canada, I think we're at 40th in our vaccination overall on the world stage. But do you believe that COVID-19, including its variants, are a permanent, it will be a part of our permanent fabric, medical health fabric in the ongoing future because of this?
It seems likely, and there's a lot of sort of arguments both ways. It's a slow mutator. COVID actually has a gene that slows down mutation, which is quite remarkable because that's not very adaptive. If you're a virus, you want to mutate a lot. Influenza is a very successful virus because it puts on a lot of disguises. It's got a whole bag of disguises it carries with it. So it mutates very rapidly and is able to evade vaccines. We have to reformulate every year. And even then, the vaccines were only partly effective. So COVID is no flu. It's a very slow mutator, and that means we ought to be able to slug it with vaccines. However, of course, it is rife across the planet. There are so many people incubating COVID that it's got a lot of room to mutate. So, and all viruses mutate. This is actually not a surprise. It's hard to know based on that. I think what tips my thinking to say that COVID is going to be endemic is the fact that it crosses between species so easily. Most viruses don't. A lot of viruses are specific not only to a species, but also to a certain kind of cell within the species. So it makes it very hard for it to jump or move around. We've seen COVID move into animal populations. I remember a lot of minks being slaughtered in Denmark, for example, not that long ago, because it was discovered that COVID moves very easily through them. That provides perhaps more opportunities for it to mutate as well. So if it ends up endemic in animals, so if we end up with what are called animal reservoirs, then we never get rid of it. It's going to be endemic for sure, and there's nothing to be done. That, to me, seems pretty likely just because this is a really flexible customer. I think that's the one thing that is COVID may be a slow mutator, which is good for us, but gosh, it's really flexible in terms of its ability to invade different kinds of cells, including cells in different species.
Just to put at ease, perhaps, or not put at ease, all the headspaces of the pet owners out there, are there particular species that it's more prone to jump to? Obviously, mammalian species, maybe. Lots of information has been made about how it possibly came from a pangolin. Obviously, the bats that many of these diseases come from is another species that it can jump from to humans. Are there specific species that are prone to perhaps picking up and incubating and being a reservoir for a variant or the original COVID?
We don't really know that landscape yet. It's probably mostly or entirely mammalian. I'm not an immunologist, and I think we'd probably want to get an opinion from an immunologist, but essentially, as you get further and further away, I mean, different kinds of animals that are very different from us, their cell structures are different, and it's less likely that the virus would be able to do that. So it's likely just mammals, and, you know, it's possible for house pets to get infected. We've seen that.
Really? We've seen house pets get infected with COVID?
That was documented in Hong Kong at least twice. It doesn't seem overly common, and so I don't want people freaking out, and I certainly don't want people abusing pets. Frankly, the way it would probably go is that you give it to your pet, not the other way around. So I think if you love your pet, then wear your mask is probably a better way to look at it.
So it's basically a one-way transmission kind of thing.
Well, your pet needs to have close contact with someone with COVID. So who's your pet having close contact with?
Right.
Right. And especially during lockdowns. I mean, you shouldn't send your pet off leash throughout the neighborhood to go and hang out with whoever they want. That would be a bad idea. Right? That's a bad idea for lots of reasons, COVID being one of them. But I think you want to keep your pet safe. You want to keep your pet safe just like you want to keep your other loved ones safe. I don't think it's any different.
Right. And my dog these days has taken to sleeping with his butt beside my head. So I wouldn't want to give him any weird flus because of that, because of how close he's decided to be during this winter. So a lot of this has been compared to the Spanish flu of 1919, inappropriately named, but there were three or four waves of that one. Obviously, they didn't have the technology to develop the vaccines for it during that time, and it kind of slowly made its way out of the circulation. Was that because it just burned through the population, or is there a natural ebb and flow, if left by themselves, to these kinds of pandemics?
I don't think we have a certain answer there. We weren't doing the kind of measurement way back then 100 years ago that we're doing now, things like blood tests to see how prevalent it is in the population. It's possible that Spanish flu attacked so many people that we ended up with natural herd immunity out of the end of it. We don't know how many people were infected with Spanish flu. We don't know how many people died. Estimates vary hugely. But there was a lot of travel at that time because there was obviously a world war. There was demobilization at the end of World War I. It went everywhere, there's no question, and it was very infectious. So it may have just died out entirely because of that. It may have gone on its own because it was edged out by a different flu. Flu strains do compete with each other a little bit. The epidemiology of flu is complicated, and in all honesty, it's not very well understood. We see different patterns in flu every year. Pandemic flu behaves differently than seasonal flu. There's influenza A and B, so you've got human influenza and you've got animal influenza. It's a very complicated tapestry, and until fairly recently, we weren't tracking this very well. And I'll say right now, no one knows from year to year how many people got the flu. It's very hard to track because you have asymptomatic cases. You have people who don't seek medical attention. So you really can compare year over year in terms of how many people actually showed up to get a flu test and then got tested positive. So even today, we've got a very fuzzy picture of just how many people get the flu every year and how much damage it does.
So with the Spanish flu, there are about 50 million deaths worldwide. Currently with COVID, I think we're at 2.5 million worldwide. Do you attribute that to just modern medicine or a distinction between the diseases themselves?
Well, I guess two things. One is we don't know if it was 50 million. It could have been more or less. We really don't. The other thing is we don't know how many people COVID will have killed by the time it's done. So these are two pretty fuzzy numbers. I think we can credit modern medicine with a lot of saving of lives. Would we be at 50 million dead right now without modern medicine? That seems to be terribly unlikely. COVID is not particularly lethal unless you happen to be quite elderly. The effect is very age graded. That was not the case for influenza. Influenza felled all sorts of young people. So it had a very, very different profile. I think it's fair to say that Spanish flu was more deadly. It was more indiscriminate and more deadly. But of course, we just don't have, we can't go back in time to take a careful scientific look, unfortunately. We didn't know until 1992, by the way, what kind of flu Spanish flu even was. There was an expedition that dug up a corpse in the Arctic. And found viable flu. That's someone who died from Spanish flu in the Arctic and was frozen the entire time. So it's only been since 92 we even know that it was an H1N1 influenza.
Wow.
So what we don't know about Spanish flu would fill books.
That's crazy. And I guess that's a good segue between the indiscriminate diseases and a discriminate one, which COVID seems to be in that it focuses acutely on those who are elderly and those with comorbidity issues. So speaking of that, we can move on to policy. My last guest on this show was Roman Baber, who is a member of provincial parliament, now sitting independently, and he was fired from the Progressive Conservative Party for voicing his concerns that we are not dedicating every little bit of effort towards singularly protecting the vulnerable populations in Ontario, and instead we are instituting a wide-ranging lockdown, which is, in his estimation, is doing more harm than good because of all the downstream effects. What do you say to that?
I think we're going to need to use a lot of economists to try and measure, and psychologists, and social workers to measure the impact of these really brutal lockdowns. I think it's no one thinks that they don't have an absolutely appalling cost. Whether they end up costing more than COVID, is the cure worse than the disease? We're going to have to try and figure that out. I think that's going to be a very important question over the next while. I'm partly sympathetic to his views. I'm not a political scientist, but presumably he got kicked out of caucus, not necessarily for his views, but for not towing the line, for disagreeing. And in a sense, that's not surprising for a government under siege to be really defensive that way. And, you know, this is a government under siege. But the idea that you can somehow identify and singularly protect people who are most vulnerable, you know, that works well on paper. But it doesn't actually ignore the complexities of real life. And even Mr. Ford has talked about the iron ring around long-term care homes. There is no iron ring. That's actually not possible. It somehow ought to be. Logically, it ought to be. but it really isn't. And that's because long-term care homes represent the worst thing for infectious disease spread, which is called population mixing. That is to say that you've got three populations. You've got a population of residents. Okay, so they're vulnerable. They're very, very vulnerable. Then you've got a population of visitors who are bringing things in all the time. And then you've got a population of long-term care home workers. Now, that's a particular concern because a lot of personal support workers, well, in fact, I would say all of them are very poorly paid, very poorly trained. They don't have the benefits of education necessarily. They may be the breadwinner in their family. They can't afford to not be paid, so they can't stay home when they're sick because they don't get paid.
And another issue is that they were cross-pollinating across multiple long-term care homes.
Well, that is icing on a very ugly cake, yes. Yeah. So there's that. But the community spread, if you look at what's gone on in Peel, for example, Peel has a lot of personal support workers living there. Racialized, marginalized, low status, low pay, low safety. That's what that population looks like. So I ask you, how do you protect long-term care homes when structurally you set it up so that the most vulnerable people, the residents of long-term care homes, have sustained and continuous contact with people whose social, demographic, economic circumstances means that they're actually at very high risk, which, by the way, includes crowded living conditions. So it's dreadful. I mean, I know that the medical officer of health of the region of Peel has said the people who are testing positive there, 25% of them who are essential workers are saying they knew they had symptoms, but they couldn't afford not to go to work. So that right there is a really big problem. But to say we need paid sick days is a very different statement than to say we can protect our most vulnerable. So it's complicated. If you want to protect your most vulnerable, you've got to make gigantic changes to the system. And even if you make those changes, I don't think you can make them fast enough. Like this is a serious structural problem. Yeah. I don't think anyone's ever going to be safe in a long-term care home, not before vaccination.
Well, long-term care homes, they're obviously regulated by the provincial government and another institution is regulated by the provincial government, which are schools, the school system, and that recently opened up today, actually, as we're recording this, is the first day it's been open since, I'd say, Christmas break. Why are they so confident that the school system is not going to be a institution of spread if they can't protect long-term care homes in the similar fashion?
Well, yeah, the circumstances are a little bit different, and I doubt they're confident. They may be projecting that, but I think everyone's got doubts about this. The big difference between schools and long-term care homes are the residents of the long-term care homes are particularly vulnerable to serious disease and death. Kids, it has seemed, the conventional wisdom since last summer has been, well, they don't seem to get very sick. They don't seem to get very sick very often. They don't seem to spread it very much. That's a contested view. And it's complicated. On one hand, you know, our top modeling epidemiologist has said very clearly, you can't pretend that there's no transmission going on. It's not possible. And those are people in schools. Yeah. Those are people who I have a lot of respect for. Then you've got frontline public health staff saying, look, if schools were transmitting illness the same way, COVID the same way that, say, flu or other kinds of viruses rip through schools, we would be seeing way more cases. We're not seeing way more cases in schools. Therefore, the transmission must be much less. However, the problem is with kids being asymptomatic, the medical establishment tends to view asymptomatic as subclinical, that is not important. In other words, kids don't look sick. We're not testing them. If we're not testing them, we may be really dramatically undercounting infections. And because they don't look sick, it's a self-perpetuating cycle. They don't look sick, we don't test them, therefore they can't be sick. So we have a really bent logic there in terms of the evidence. There's only one way to settle this question, and that is to do universal testing of kids. And that's something that the province has not said it's going to do. I know that it's said it wants to test, I think, its goals. I've seen documents just today around policy directives to public health units. I think the plan will be that one third of all kids are going to somehow get tested just about once in the roughly 16 weeks left until the end of school. And there's a minimum sampling rate that they want from different school boards and different schools. So they're doing the bare minimum kind of surveillance testing that might be adequate to confirm that there's no COVID in schools. But they're not going to find no COVID in schools. They're going to find COVID. At the very least, schools are going to represent what's going on in the communities nearby. If the modeling epidemiologists are correct, then schools are actually amplifiers, and we're going to see slightly higher rates if we look, if we test people, not because they look sick. If we test kids not because they're complaining of a sore throat, but we test them because they're kids at a school. So I've said that we should and could open schools and should open schools, but we should do that in lockstep with universal testing. We've got 2.5 million kids in Ontario schools, which means we should be doing 2.5 million rapid tests on kids every week. The capacity that Ontario has planned for is not 2.5 million per week. It's 50,000 per week. So it's off by about a factor of 50. We would need 50 times more testing capacity in order to do the universal testing of kids that I think we need to do to stay safe. And because we're not doing that, I think schools are probably not going to stay open for very long. I think we're going to find COVID where we look for it, and I think we're going to find that we're going to have to close down. And I think that's tragic.
I agree with that 100%. My contention with the schools being open is that there's not enough contact tracing going on. There's not enough forensic tracking of the cases, the asymptomatic cases where kids every day at school, they come back home. They might go to home to a multi-generational household where they have an elderly grandparent living with them. And then suddenly it spreads throughout. Because we do know that when kids do have cases, it burns through the whole family unit, right? So,
well, it can. It certainly can. There's no question in my mind that is a significant risk. The other piece that I think we need to talk about if we're talking about COVID in schools is there was a rushed, you know, last September, a rushed granting program from the province to say, school boards, here's some money. Fix your ventilation, make your school safe. Just take care of that, will you? I even remember Mr. Ford saying, you know, don't be bureaucratic about this. Don't waste time. You've got no time to waste. It was already September. I was asking in May, what are we going to do about schools in September? You can't fix ventilation systems in a week or two, and you can't do it with the paltry few thousand dollars accorded to each school. So we have not done much. And I know, I'm sure some schools and some school boards have been heroic doing everything they can. However, that's probably not going to be enough, at least in some schools. And they range from very old buildings with radiators and no forced air to buildings that have windows that are painted shut to classrooms that have no windows at all. That's what we see across the province. Now, some schools are newer or fortunately perhaps just got their ventilation systems replaced. But those kinds of changes are not trivial. They're not tiny. And moreover, and I think this is probably most upsetting, and we haven't had a really good conversation about this, I haven't heard anything about checking humidity levels in schools. We tend to have dry air, dry warmed air in the winter because winter air is drier, there's lower absolute humidity. So when we heat that cool air, it's quite dry.
Yep.
That's very dangerous. That's extremely dangerous. You exhale droplets on a humid day, they get bigger and fall to the floor. You exhale droplets in hot, dry air, those droplets evaporate. They get lighter. They stay in the air longer. You know, COVID could start to look a lot more contagious like measles if you give it the opportunity to do that. Now, we can fix this. We can put humidifiers in schools, but we haven't said we're going to do that. That's a mistake. That's a giant mistake. That's extremely risky. And I have had conversations with individual teachers where I said, go to Canadian Tire, get a humidifier, stick it in your classroom. Don't ask, just do it.
Yeah.
What are they going to do? Put you in jail? Humidify your classroom, because this is the sort of thing we need to get done. But it shouldn't be on teachers to have to go and do that. That shouldn't be their job. No employee should actually have to bear the burden of making their own workplace safe. And this isn't just a workplace. It's where we're sending our kids. So I think, you know, I can only look at that as being negligent. We could open schools and we could do it safely. Other countries have. But these are steps that we needed to have taken. We put our heads in the sand and we've assumed that things are going to be okay. And now we've added a little bit of testing. As I say, 50,000 per week. Okay, so we'll have some data. That's better than no data. But I don't think that data is going to bring us very good news.
Yeah. And do you think it's because, if given that we don't have the absolute testing regime in place, should they have delayed the opening of schools? Yes or no?
Well, I guess they already did, certainly in Toronto. But I'm not sure what the delay bought us. Like, I didn't hear we're delaying it so that we can fix ventilation. I didn't hear we're delaying it so we can humidify schools. And I certainly didn't hear we're delaying it so we can get a testing regime in place. I didn't hear any of those things. Perhaps they were doing them all in secret and decided not to boast, but that seems very unlikely to me.
Yeah.
So I, I think the delay is a bit of a head scratcher. Delaying March break in Ontario is also a bit of a head scratcher. I'm not sure what delaying does. What we've seen since last March is when you delay on making decisions about how to protect people, you end up increasing the size of the problem, right? So lockdowns represent a failure, in my mind. They represent a failure to take adequate proactive steps. The way to manage a pandemic is to prevent cases, not to wait until they get so high that you then have to shut down, or so high that you then have to delay schools opening. But I don't know what the delay, I don't know what the delay is said to have accomplished.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that I've spoken to a lot of parents on this, and they're like, well, there's no evidence that it's being spread in schools. I'm saying there's no evidence because they're not collecting any evidence. And in the absence of evidence, you take a cautious approach. You don't open schools just thinking that it's going to be bellwether at the end of the day because you put in a month and a half delay. But we can move on from that because there's a lot of what I'm also noticing right now is that as the vaccine's getting rolled out, there is a lot of apprehension. And I'm not talking about apprehension from conspiracy theorists or just really irrational people. These are well-reasoned people that I speak to who also have, some are even in the medical field who are saying, well, I'm holding out. I'm not getting the vaccine. I don't trust it. It's too new, even though it isn't. It hasn't been tested enough, even though it has. Can you speak to that a little bit? And with the perhaps aim of satiating people's concerns about this?
Yeah. So, you know, the central issue here is trust. There's no question that's trust. Who is trying to make you take the vaccine and who's suggesting it and do you trust them? That actually has a lot to do with it. If Mr. Ford's a polarizing person. Some people love him, some people very much the opposite. If he's the person telling you to take a vaccine, there's a lot of people who don't want public health advice from him. We don't train physicians to be able to talk effectively to patients about vaccine hesitancy. That's a problem, because your physician is someone you ought to be able to trust. So if we're not equipping them to do that, and we've got politicians saying, no, really, trust me, I'm from the government, I'm here to help, that's not confidence inspiring for a lot of people. At the same time, we can say there's been enough testing, or we could also say, is there ever enough? Certainly some of the severe anaphylaxis that we have seen, it hasn't killed anyone yet, but it's concerning. That never showed up in the safety trials. It used to take many years to develop a vaccine, many years, and the safety trials went on for longer. These have been compressed. I am going to get the vaccine. You know, my family members, my kids are going to get the vaccine. I trust the vaccine, but it really does revolve around my own assessment of the situation and understanding that. And I have, you know, more knowledge than the average bear about what that entails. So I feel like I can trust. But let's differentiate between people who are vaccine hesitant, who for whom I think a trusting conversation needs to happen, and people who are anti-vax. People who are anti-vax, there's nothing to be done about them. Fortunately, it's a small proportion of the population, and you don't need to vaccinate everybody to protect everybody. So I figure there's not much we can do there. I think we should probably not try and win converts in that group. We should be focusing on the people who are vaccine hesitant, who are scratching their heads going, is this safe? Is this, you know, I'm concerned about this. I think vaccine hesitancy has decreased over the last several months. I think it was at its height in around November, when we didn't have a vaccine available, when Mr. Trump was talking about applying political pressure to get approvals done. Anytime you mix that, that's a real recipe for people certainly not trusting. We know that the Russian vaccine and maybe the Chinese vaccine was rushed into implementation with not nearly the kind of testing that we might want to see. So there's a global zeitgeist of, well, just put it in a syringe and inject people and hope for the best.
Well, that's there's also the issue of Sinovac coming out as being only 50% effective as well.
But that's different from the safety consideration, right? So if people are absolutely certain a vaccine's safe, then the next question is, well, how protected will I be? How effective is it? I think that's a different question. It ultimately gets down to some people are really freaked out about having things injected into them. And that probably shouldn't be surprising in a sense. I mean, I grew up accepting vaccines and I don't have that particular concern, but a lot of people do. And we need to know, we need to actually develop ways to be able to talk to those folks really effectively. But I think vaccine hesitancy is going to diminish. Millions and millions of doses are going to go. You're going to have situations eventually where you need to demonstrate immunity, say, in order to attend school. Certain jobs may require it. You will certainly need it in order to travel. So there's going to be a lot of limitations. And you could say, look, I'm going to homeschool my kids and never travel and not get the vaccine. But for a lot of people, ultimately, there's going to be some social pressure to do that. And that'll come in lockstep with most people having had it and most people having survived it. So I think that's probably the best way forward. No one should be compelled to have a vaccine and vaccination, because that adds to the ranks of the anti-vaxxers. And I guess the last thing I want to say is healthcare workers are a particularly special case. And I've studied healthcare workers in the flu vaccine, and typically uptake rates are very, very low. And we could have a whole session just to talk about that particular thing. But what I'll say is, with respect to flu shots and also COVID shots, you've got, I think, was it Windsor? There's one region where in at least one hospital, half the staff are refusing the vaccine. Half. Now, that's worrisome. That's really high. And you might think, healthcare workers are supposed to know better. But the fact of the matter is, it's trust, because in this case, it's their employer trying to inject them. A lot of people don't want to be injected by their employers. And so that puts healthcare workers in a particularly special case. And a lot of them have not had great work experiences. It's tough to work in healthcare. It's hard. And trust gets eroded in those circumstances.
And that anecdote echoes what we did a whole episode on misinformation spread in Canada around COVID, where masking and vaccines, and some of the findings in that episode, and I'll link it in the show notes below, were that those who do work in the medical field show a higher rate of hesitancy when it comes to taking vaccines and whatever else. I posited that perhaps, you know, their whole social media world has other communities of health-minded people. And perhaps they're getting an overabundance of some of the misinformation that's being spread out there as well. But who knows where that direction lies at the end of the day.
Yeah, the research I did lands squarely on trust and its employer trust. And if you think about it, if your employer said, I need to inject this into you, whether you say yes or no is going to depend very much on if you trust the person who's saying this. And I think that's what it is for a lot of healthcare workers.
It's interesting. Can you speak to the case of Israel, who seems to be accelerating way ahead in terms of its vaccination schedule and some of the social access programs that they're planning to implement? I read the other day about a green card being implemented to allow you to attend very public events like concerts and sporting events. And if you can speak to the success of their vaccine rollout and the attitudes there, if you're familiar with that example at all, and how that can translate to Canada.
Yeah, no, I have some. I mean, I certainly know from a health informatics standpoint, Israel has an enviable healthcare system. It's modern, it's electronic, it's all compact. It's not a big country in terms of square kilometers or population. And some of these problems that we're having with vaccines, with healthcare generally, it's a problem of scale. It's trying to do things at a really big scale. So they've got some advantages in being compact and also being quite modern. Culturally also, they're quite used to being under a state of emergency. They're very efficient. They survive is really high on their list of priorities. They don't take things for granted. So I think they're far more oriented to just a military-like efficiency in terms of protecting the population. That's a very salient thing in that part of the world. So I think that actually feeds into it quite a lot. They had their own missteps. They opened schools quite confidently, and it was a disaster, right? They did it without that kind of preparation. Denmark opened schools and had a great experience. Israel did, and it was a real mess. Israel also has Orthodox populations, and you know the extremes in many religions tend to be vaccine hesitant. It's an interesting phenomenon. I don't know if that's been studied systematically, but Israel is certainly no exception. In fact, among Orthodox Jewish populations in Brooklyn, New York, they went to the Supreme Court around being able to reopen, around not having to obey public health dictates, and they actually won. About avoiding safety. So Israel's got its problems too, but by and large, they've got some, obviously, as I say, some attributes that predict success. They're pretty serious about it, and it's actually really impressive.
I've been reading stories about it every day, and I'm increasingly impressed about how efficient and effective their policy and their rollouts have been. Going back a little bit to the downstream effects of lockdown, obviously my previous guest is against it and cites the downstream effects such as the lack of cancer screenings going on, the mental health issues, obviously the economic effects on businesses and people's income and unemployment, social isolation, eating disorders. In your analysis and your everyday analysis of what's going on, do you see evidence of that happening? Obviously, the economic effects, we see stores shutting down and whatever else, but I'm speaking to perhaps things like the mental health issues. I know it's probably not your field of expertise, but is that a metric that is paid attention to by the wider community? And should there be a shift policy-wise? I know this is a long question. Should there be a shift policy-wise to not just go by what the medical doctors are saying, the chief medical doctors are saying, but include other disciplines, like you said, the economists, the psychologists, a round table of sorts of medical experts and social science experts in the conversation to chart a path forward?
There's a lot to chew on there.
Sorry, it's a long-winded question, but I want to address this comprehensively.
First and foremost, the idea that we're going to flip a switch and lock down, actually, that's at the behest of politicians. I don't know public health people who say that that's a good idea. In other words, there's other things that you should be doing, and by that I mean prevention. And the advice from public health to decision makers from the beginning has been to take early steps to prevent this from having to happen. To be more specific, the very first lockdown we had in March, we needed to have because we didn't know what we were dealing with and we needed to buy some time. We needed to retool our healthcare system. We thought the lethality may be a lot higher. It was terrifying. You may remember we were fining people for sitting on park benches. No one knew. There was just terror. And I think a brief lockdown was in order. It went on two or three times as long as it should because we left candy stores open and pie shops. I mean, we didn't really lock down. So we did kind of a half measures approach that I think multiplied the suffering. I could go buy pie fresh, but I may not be able to go to my job. But that's not good. And that is not public health advice. That's a political implementation. From that point in the summer, when case counts were really, really low, public health people, and I was one of them, were waving our arms saying, we need to plan now. We need to stop flying. We need to close things down, some things down, when we open schools. And by some things, I don't mean lockdowns. I mean, it was really clear from an infection control standpoint that in-restaurant dining and air travel were going to make everybody miserable. Everybody. It's not worth it. And what I said again and again is if we just stopped in-restaurant dining and air travel at the same time that we opened schools, we wouldn't have a second wave. We would have little outbreaks here and there, just like they do in the Atlantic provinces. That's public health guidance right there. When you hear public health people saying, well, looks like we're going to have to lock down, it's not because they think lockdowns are a good idea. It's because we no longer have any choice because we didn't make the smart decisions to actually do prevention. We had the opportunity to do that, and we didn't. Cases are dropping in Ontario right now. What are we doing? We're opening everything up without the kind of planning we need. I have been a firm believer and a proponent of doing mass rapid testing. I've been waving my arms about that since last May. We could test our way out of this. It's not a crazy idea. It's been demonstrated in a lot of other places, and why we will not learn from this.
Is it just a matter of capacity? They just don't have the rapid tests?
They can be purchased, but as far as capacity goes, I remember Mr. Ford talking last summer about how we were going to get to up to, I think it was 50,000 tests a day, and he was really beaming about what capacity that was. And I thought to myself, you actually have to start by calculating what do you need. We've got 15 million people in Ontario. 50,000 tests a day isn't even close. If we're going to open restaurants, we need to test servers. If we're going to open stores, we need to test clerks. If we're opening schools, we need to test teachers. We've got 170,000 teachers in Ontario alone, never mind other kinds of frontline workers who have occupational risk. So if you're going to open, you need to test. And if you test, you can stay open. So public health guidance ought to be do that testing.
Oh, I think you dropped out there, yeah.
No, I'm here. I just, hang on, give me a second. I'll be right back. My battery is flagging. I neglected to plug it in.
Perfect, you're back.
Yeah. I'm back, yeah.
Didn't want to lose you so early. There's still a little bit to go. And I appreciate your insight on there. So weighing your estimation is explaining, in my estimation, a negligent approach in that there are not multiple circles and angles of approach in prevention and also treatment of this. It's just this kind of giant lockdown of everything and everyone with this color-coded thing.
Yeah, it's a very blunt approach, and in some ways it couldn't be worse. We lock down small stores, but we leave big box stores open. That's exactly the opposite of what you should be doing. Big box stores have big parking lots and big crowds and big staff and big outbreaks. Small stores don't.
Is it because the big box stores can be more easily held accountable, or the population?
They're not been. They've not been, though. We haven't. We have. I mean, more recently we said, well, we're going to crack down on those big box stores. Well, that feels like it's a day late and a dollar short. No, there was no announcement or around enforcement at all. No, I don't believe that. I think if you want to know why big box stores were left open while small businesses were closed, I think you need a political scientist to talk about that, because there's no public health basis for doing that. It is absolutely opposite to what we ought to want to do. But I want to add something else in here, and this kind of lets the government off the hook a little bit. That is to say that when I say it, a sound public health approach is prevention and prevention through testing, we have a big problem here, and that is that there are people in public health who don't agree with that. There are people in public health who don't understand testing theory the way they ought to understand testing theory, and don't understand communicable disease the way they ought to.
Why?
And well, it has to do with training. Not everyone can know everything. That's one thing. Another thing is, this is really new, right? When we say novel, we really mean it. Well, evidence-based medicine isn't very good at dealing with novel things. In another 10 or 15 years, we'll have randomized controlled trials, we'll have systematic reviews, we'll have odds ratios, we'll have all this really hard evidence that medicine absolutely loves. But to adopt a problem-solving dynamic mindset, in other words, how do we make the stop now? Medicine's actually not very good at doing that. And if you apply what you know about testing theory for chronic diseases like kidney disease or heart disease, you don't want to test very much. You actually want to manage it somewhat differently. And that gets a little bit technical, but my point is that a lot of people in public health just haven't actually connected the dots to say, oh, this is different and we need to pull out rapid testing. So if you're a government and you're not hearing a solid perspective, a unified perspective from public health, it's not exactly a compelling case. Now, Ontario's own chief medical officer of health, there's someone who's anti-testing. And he didn't want to have a mask mandate. He has opposed testing. He's absolutely opposed it. I mean, he's literally said, look, if we do this widespread testing, we're going to find more cases. Well, right.
That's the point.
That's the point. And this guy is on the public record saying that, and so is his associate. So you actually have a lot of people in public health who haven't actually wrapped their heads around this. And now if we got them on a panel and said, you oppose testing, do you think lockdowns are better? I'd be curious to see what they have to say, because I don't think that's a defensible position. Lockdowns are harmful. You listed some of the tribulations of lockdowns, but you missed a couple. Domestic violence. Domestic violence against babies. The Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario, I believe, reported a marked increase in babies with physical injuries. That's appalling. I don't know, how does it get worse than that, right? The effects of lockdowns are absolutely appalling. And I'd really like to line up everyone in public health who has opposed testing and said, this is what you're buying with your attitude. We could have, we should have, in a unified way, told the government in no uncertain terms, you need to build a testing capacity. And we had the whole summer to do it. Our health minister tweeted every day in the summer about how little COVID there was. There weren't any tweets about preparing for the fall. There weren't any tweets about how do we stay open. There weren't any tweets about using surveillance testing to control transmission. And that's where the government failed. But you know what? Public health didn't give them the unified voice that it needed to do.
Well, I mean, way to let the government off the hook, but really, it was a lot of... I mean, I believe that when you get to that level of public health, When you're creating policy at that level, you operate more politically than you do out of expertise, but then tend to hide every once in a while behind your impartial expertise. Having been someone who has dealt with that on the municipal, provincial, and federal levels, I can attest to that. But I want to shift a little bit and turn to the world stage and your idea of prevention here. Obviously, Canada was taking its cues from the World Health Organization, as were many countries at the outset of this. Some countries, however, weren't, and everyone who's watched this cast understands how much I love Taiwan and their response to this. But I also highlighted a lot as an example of how politics got in the way of good policy in terms of our response to a crisis. And I speak to how Taiwan had the perfect implementation, as far as perfection goes in this instance, of, I believe it was their 42-point plan that they put into place right away. They started putting restrictions at their airports and borders on December 31st, 2019. They sent a fact-finding mission to Wuhan in the early days. They were ringing the alarm bells about human-to-human transmission while the WHO was taking cues from China and saying that there's no evidence of it. And it angers me so much that even today, even as of last week, the WHO went on a fact-finding mission to Wuhan and came back and said, oh, all's clear, you know, it might have been frozen food. How much damage has been done, and how much lack of trust in institutions is the World Health Organization and their incompetence on this file? They do a lot of great work, but on this file, their incompetence and what I call a captive agency now. How much damage have they done in terms of world trust in giant health bodies and using Taiwan as the alternate example of someone who didn't listen to them and now has a COVID-free country?
So let's be clear that the World Health Organization, as you say, has done and continues to do some absolutely amazing, indispensable work. And
if
if we vilify the entire organization, we shoot ourselves in the foot. So let's be clear about that. The thing about the World Health Organization is it's a child or a product of globalization. It has a global perspective by definition. World is the first word in its title, right? It's not health organization for the world. It's the World Health Organization. That's actually meaningful. In other words, they can't actually conceive of what a particular country might need to stay safe. Their level of analysis by definition is global, and they could not conceive of a travel ban. They couldn't conceive of it. It would be anathema. It's speaking poison. If you're a child of globalization, you can't conceive of saying, let's all disconnect. So they had a blind spot based on their positionality as a globalized institution. Some of Mr. Trump's criticism may well be valid, that they had a China virus bias. That's hard to actually parse. That's actually hard to tell. I prefer to look at it mostly as they have a big blind spot, and that blind spot is that they're a product of globalization, and therefore they're making political decisions and political recommendations. The World Health Organization at its best is providing scientific advice to give cover, political cover, for governments to make difficult decisions. So the World Health Organization had an opportunity to say, it's going to hurt, but we've got to ground flights for a while. That's what they could have and should have done. But again, it's not something that they can actually perceive. They just there's no chance. They did it again in the summer when they were so resistant to the idea of aerosols. This is a complicated topic because the evidence is pretty unclear. And I have my own theory that actually accommodates that, but it is still just that. It's a theory. And the problem is it's equivocal. That is to say, I look at it as tipping points. Let's say for a moment that when your kids go to school every day, or you go to work, or wherever you are, that you almost get sick. Every time you go to the grocery store, you almost get infected. Just assume that's true for a moment. Masks have a way of interfering with that, right? They're even crappy masks that really aren't fitting very well. They provide enough interference. They disrupt aerosols so that aerosols that are kind of dangerous stop being dangerous. Okay, so that's an idea. That's the idea of a tipping point, essentially. That means, if that's true, that means in some circumstances aerosols will be quite dangerous. That is to say that if you're immersed in an aerosol environment for long enough, you may well get sick. And so you have restaurant outbreaks where one person got someone sick at the opposite side of the restaurant and no one can figure out how that happened. Must be aerosols. And the World Health Organization has said, can't be, right? Must be droplet, can't be aerosol because not everyone in the restaurant got sick. So there's a conventional wisdom there around aerosols and around the fact that this can't be. They're really stuck to that. And so it was in July, I think it was the 8th of July, to look back in my calendar, when 239 scientists wrote an open letter to the WHO. And it's a political letter. It's a letter of embarrassment saying, you're letting everyone down. Stop ignoring aerosols. You don't have to endorse aerosols, just stop ignoring them. This is right. causing... And it was embarrassing. And so after that, they went, okay, so maybe aerosol's a thing. But still not really. And in fact, locally, by the way, here in Ontario, that same conventional wisdom continues to put people at risk. And that is to say that public health guidelines here in Ontario classify COVID as droplet only. And that means, hold on to your seat for this, and I have observed this directly, staff in long-term care homes are being told not to use N95 masks to care for COVID-positive residents. Let that sink in. They're not using N95 masks. They're being taken away, in fact. No N95 masks for long-term care home workers caring for COVID-positive patients. Why? Because COVID is droplet only. If COVID is droplet only, you don't need an N95 mask. Yet we have plenty of evidence that if you're in close quarters with someone, you ought to be very concerned about aerosols. So the WHO has led with this, or failed to lead, I guess I should say, with this inertia around aerosols. And that's had impacts. You know, the long-term care home within walking distance from where you are right now is actually suffering because of that policy. So the WHO has a huge impact. It's got a gigantic impact, and therefore a gigantic, I think, responsibility. And it has fallen short. It's fallen short in terms of implementing what is very simply known in public health as the precautionary principle. If you're not sure, assume it's harmful. The burden is to assume it's safe. Let's assume aerosols are harmful. Let's look at the evidence and say, we think this is harmful. And eventually we may decide that it isn't. That's very different than the inertia that says, no, we have a droplet categorization for respiratory viruses. It's always been droplet. It must be droplet. And therefore, we don't even want to talk about it. So they failed really badly on that. Air travel and then droplets versus aerosol. And that's had that's cost a lot of lives.
And I just to clarify, my comments about the WHO aren't a Trump talking point, although he has used that talking point to exploit his situation for his own political gain. There's no love between me and that guy. But I'm going by, there's a Washington Post article, Washington Post or New York Times, in Hunt for Virus Source, WHO let China take charge, in which they detail some of the internal discussions that were happening at the time and why the decisions were being made, and a lot of sensitivity towards China went into a lot of their public announcements and their hesitations about this. So there is evidence to back up that assertion. But going, and then also, it also prevented Taiwan from getting a lot of its warnings out to the world, because obviously Taiwan is not being allowed onto the world stage because of its political entanglements with mainland China. But are you familiar with the Taiwan example of its prevention strategy?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, it's Taiwan's got something really special, which is to say it actually produces a lot of the world's supply of masks. And in Asia, generally, mask wearing culturally is really no big deal. This is what I'm told. And so in Taiwan, to say, everyone put on a mask now. Back when we were saying, here, we don't think masks matter, right? Because we hadn't actually done the critical thinking. And actually, to be honest, their reasons for wearing masks may be misplaced, right? It may well be that people in Taiwan think that putting on a mask protects themselves. In actual fact, they're protecting others from their droplets, but the outcome's the same. Everyone wears a mask and everyone's safer. So even if the logic wasn't quite right, the compulsion certainly was. And I think that's a big, big piece of it just right there, just that. Had we known, could we go back in time? And I've been asked this. Had we known, had we put masks on people right away, could this have played out differently? Would this have? Well, the spring would have. But I think every mistake that we made after that into the second wave, I think, would have continued. So it's not just that initial thing. You actually need the wisdom and the mindset to work on prevention rather than reaction. And I think that's huge. New Zealand's done it. Australia, kind of a hybrid, a bit of both. Iceland, very good at prevention. So you've got places, and I think being an island might have something to do with it.
They have a similar population to Canada and almost as many international airports, but they also have the benefit of their vice president being an epidemiologist, so there's that. But they also had an infectious disease prevention strategy in place, that 42-point plan. I, just as more disclosure, I came from Taiwan in March, so I got to see their response on the ground. They literally had community health clinics on every corner in every neighborhood. These are just out on the sidewalk, so the elderly can come get tested. They had every week, each citizen got an allotment of 10 masks for free that they could pick up at any pharmacy or storefront. Every institution and facility that you went into, they were forehead screening for fever. They were spraying hands. Every staff member inside would have masks on. They only went into lockdown. They locked down their schools for 2 weeks and some bars and restaurants for, I believe, a week. And they were able to get in front of this really early because they were monitoring it really early. They actually have a media monitoring service where they actually monitor social media in other countries, including China, and that's how it came on their radar to begin with. They sent a message over to the WHO on December 31st saying, hey guys, something's here, we don't know what it is, but you guys should take a look at this. But speaking of early detection, the CDC, in analyzing some blood samples, some blood donation samples from 2019, found that coronavirus was already in the country, in the U.S., prior to even the genome being sequenced on January 12th. Was the same true in Canada? Is there any evidence of that? Have we done that analysis at all? If it was in the country in 2019 already?
Canada has been pretty disappointing in terms of its interest in forensics, its interest in figuring out what happened and when, and doing seroprevalence and testing blood samples. We've done very little of that. Might COVID have arrived here? Yep, quite possibly. I mean, we do a lot of travel. I think it's been postulated that it arrived in New York City at least four times separately and burned out each time. That is to say, COVID has what's called low dispersal. That is to say, it's not that everyone who gets it passes it on to one or two other people. That's actually not how it works. A lot of people pass it on to no one at all. And then once in a while, someone passes it on to a whole ton of people all at once. And so when COVID arrives with one person on a plane, if that person is going to end up in a super spreader situation, then you get an outbreak. And if they're not, especially if they end up having a fairly mild presentation of the disease, it goes away. So yeah, we don't really know where it came from. We know it blew up in Wuhan. We don't know where it came from. We don't have that missing link. And because of that, because we don't know where, we also don't know when, and because we don't know when, we also don't know where. It's really the two of them together. I suspect we may be looking in the wrong place. I have no evidence for that, except to say that a food market in Wuhan is a pretty easy to describe place. We can talk about the kinds of produce and animals that are sold there, and I think that's been looked into, and we still haven't connected all the dots there. So,
well, I mean, they were allowed back a year later. They disposed of all the wastewater. They completely sanitized the whole the food market. The WHO was allowed into the labs for 3 hours. I mean, it was farcical, and even the U.S. State Department stated how farcical their conclusions were in that. So Canada doesn't do any forensics. They don't do any forensics.
We really don't.
That's so sad.
Yeah, it is. And I think when people were dying, I said, why are we not doing some post-mortem testing of people in non-misadventure deaths? Because we're not even sure who COVID's killing. And had we done that, we probably would have learned a little sooner that COVID is causing blood coagulation and catastrophic strokes. We might have found people who were older and died of stroke. Well, maybe it was COVID. And there's obviously a lot of grieving relatives who now will never know. And I asked publicly, and I managed to get some journalists to put the question to our chief medical officer of health. And he said, well, that's the coroner's job. And so the same journalist asked the coroner of Ontario, and he said, that's the chief medical officer of health.
They're doing this.
And they know each other. They know each other. So it's not like they couldn't pick up the phone and have a conversation about this, but neither one had the curiosity. And that's a culturally, that's actually a really huge problem. Neither one actually saw it as something that was worth doing. And I'm not talking about a giant amount of time or a giant amount of money. I'm talking about do a few and see what you find. They wouldn't do it. And so that's the Canadian, that's the really the Canadian response there. And it's pretty darn disappointing. It's honestly really kind of embarrassing. As for China being somewhat secretive, you know, I'm not a political scientist, much less an expert on China, but I think you need to look at not they're being secret because they've got something to hide, but this is profoundly embarrassing.
Absolutely.
Embarrassment matters huge. It matters absolutely huge, I think, from a cultural standpoint, that is, we could take embarrassment maybe and not see it as being nearly as big a deal as they might over there. And so their set of assumptions around why are people nosing around, foreigners nosing around, it could be very sensitive for them. So I don't see the lack of cooperation necessarily as a sign that they're hiding something or that they're culpable. More like they're probably really deeply uncomfortable with this kind of scrutiny. And that's a very, very different scenario entirely.
Yeah.
And they may not be fully appreciating how this looks to everybody else. So I think that the cultural gap there may account for a lot of the difficulties and misinterpretation and the suspicion.
I mean, I agree to an extent. And when I say China, I don't mean China. I mean the Communist Party of China, the CCP,
fair,
who has been very actually bullish in them pointing fingers at other and spreading conspiracy theory and shooting down any criticism of their response to this, including them actually silencing one of the whistleblowers early on in the pandemic breakout. I mean, it's almost criminal at the end of the day. And as someone who is a practicer and a student and of political science, I look at it as a failure of politics, as well as an embarrassment. But the embarrassment is that, you know, there's a country there that there's a government there that bases a lot of its power on perceptions, and they are fighting like hell to keep their perceptions on the world stage pristine, failing at it, but pristine, and that is a lot of what's informing their policy around this, and it's sad. It's very sad that there can't be more cooperation on that front. And it's also sad that our experts on the ground there haven't done as comprehensive of a job as they could have. But shifting away from all that and how it seems like no one's really steering the ship, even though they are. I mean, we still have a vaccine rollout. We still have assurances from the federal government that everyone who wants a vaccine will be able to get one by September. So there are positives in this and in going into the future. If you were, you know, rolling your magic eight ball a little bit, where do you see us in the medium term, let's say by early summer, by next fall, in a year from now? What does it look like to you if status quo is maintained or if a few other policy shifts are implemented?
I'm not sure what status quo looks like in such a rapidly changing field. So, you know, I'll give you what I think are some predictions. My so-called crystal ball has been pretty good over the last 10 months, but you're only as good as your last prediction. I think the third wave of variants is going to be rapid and it's going to be unpleasant and it's going to be in April. But I also think, and when I say unpleasant, I worry about our health system. I worry about our health system breaking. That's the big problem. We vaccinated long-term care home residents, but this our healthcare system breaking would create a whole new set of victims. But I think it'll be short-lived because the weather warms, because vaccination comes. Those two things will be very protective. It feels to me like by the time we get to summer, we're going to start shaking off lockdowns and restrictions slowly. It's going to be a process. It's going to take time. But I think we'll be able to do that without the dread of, oh, here we go again. That when we are able to open restaurants, that they'll be able to stay open. That's my belief. And so I think the summer is going to be a recovery of what normal looks like. And we're not going to get all the way there in the summer. Variants and vaccines, there's going to be a game of whack-a-mole. So it's a slow mutating virus and we're getting faster at vaccines. So I think we win. But I think over the next year, we're going to have booster rounds, that mass vaccination once, or I should say twice with Pfizer and Moderna. No, I think there's going to be boosters. I think there's going to be boosters to handle different variants. And that game of whack-a-mole, I think, goes in our favor. I think we will be able to manage that faster than COVID is able to produce variants of concern. That assumes that we remain committed to limiting travel. If we decide politically that we want people traveling all over the place all over again, then we're going to speed up variants. And if we speed up variants, we're going to stretch this out a long, long way. So I think much depends on the political will to recognize the air travel as being particularly pernicious, that it fosters population mixing, which is a terrible, terrible idea. And if we can just keep travel to a dull roar over the next year while we catch up with variants, then I think we win. I think we do okay. But it's going to be a while before things like masks and can come off and large gatherings happen. I'm not expecting large gatherings this summer. I think we're probably will need to have masks. And I think in solidarity with people who are still at risk globally, I think there's something to be said for that, that kind of mindfulness, because we're really globally, we're all in it together. Ultimately, I see a happy ending, and I see that happy ending starting this summer. But it's going to be a long last chapter.
Well, that's definitely a positive way to end off the show. I really appreciate you coming on and spending some time with us to help walk us through some of these really important issues and complex issues, frankly. And I really enjoyed the cast in that respect. So thank you, Colin. And once again, I will not hesitate to ask you to come back on again. So expect another email in the near future if things are to develop a little differently and we need a little bit more insight. I really appreciate it coming from you. Is there any way that anyone can get in touch with you if they need to, if they have any further questions?
My email address is findable. The problem is the people who find it tend to be people who are suffering badly under lockdowns and sometimes need someone to shout at. So that's you know, I probably don't need any more of that.
Okay.
But
I do hear
from Canadians with questions, and to the extent that I'm able, I do try and be responsive. I wish everyone had someone near to them that they could ask questions from, that they could trust, that they could get some reassurance from, because I think that's in short supply.
Okay. Colin, thank you. Take care and stay safe.
Sure. My pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Lockdown Toronto. I really appreciate you coming along for the ride. I really found this episode really interesting, and I hope you did too. If you want to watch it online, there's a bunch of past episodes you can watch. You can listen to them, subscribe in your podcatcher, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you find it. Just look for Lockdown Toronto. You can also go to pod6.com to catch all the links there. You can comment on Facebook on our page there, the Pod6 Network. And if you have any questions or concerns, info@pod6.com. We'll get them right to me. That's info@pod6ix.com. And that will send you an email straight to me. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next one.